a glorious piece of aviation history. Years of meticulous restoration. Until finally, VR-796 takes flight.
Mosquito's special because it's fast, versatile.
It's rare, it's beautiful. It was an astonishing airplane for its time.
Built out of wood with a high altitude performance.
But due to the wooden structure of the Mosquito, there's just not very many of these things left. That's what makes this one really special.
When the wooden de Havilland Mosquito first took flight in 1940, it was the fastest machine on the planet and became the most versatile weapon of World War II.
They could just about outmaneuver any German fighters.
And could deliver one, quite a punch.
If you ever wanted to own a Ferrari, the Mosquito was like that to any other aircraft I'd ever flown.
Delight to fly.
But for over a decade, no Mosquitoes were flying.
As if they were left outside and got wet, they deteriorated and rotted away.
Finally, in 2009, Victoria Air Maintenance began restoring an original Mosquito to take to the skies once again.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
This one is built from an original fuselage. This wood is the wood that was in the aircraft when it was flying.
It's an extraordinarily complex project.
For as long as I have had my heart invested in vintage airplanes, and the Mosquito in particular, I've never seen one fly before.
There's going to be some tears in people's eyes, I'm sure, when it flies for the first time.
In the design of aircraft, some are just right. This one was just right and still is.
Everybody knows the Mosquito. They were built in Canada, so it has a lot of local history. It's just such a rare and famous airplane. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for anybody who gets to work on it.
This Mosquito, serial number VR-796, and Canadian registration CF-HML, was built in England as a bomber just after World War II ended. Owner Robert Jens has brought his plane to world-famous Victoria Air Maintenance to be restored to flying condition.
I started as an aircraft engineer, an apprentice in 1965, and kind of went the other way. I was an engineer before I went flying. They don't get any rarer, and it'd be a great thrill to see this actually fly.
This is one of the projects that would definitely would be the crown of my career.
It is special, there's no doubt about it. The challenge of building an airplane that there are no other of, that people can come and see and remember about. It's exciting.
We've done a lot of cool stuff here over the years, and you know, most of us are pretty used to working on, you know, rather cool toys all the time. But you very seldom anyone ever gets to work on a Mosquito.
Guys like Mel and myself, this is more of a hobby for us. We get paid for it, which is great. We don't consider it a real job, I guess. We like to build things and put things back together.
Today, despite over 7,000 Mosquitoes being built, there are only 30 Mozzies left in the world. Of the four in Canada, this will be the only flying example. In Calgary, a Mosquito is currently being restored by volunteers to ground running condition.
Behind us is a de Havilland Mosquito of pretty much the same model as the one in Victoria. It's a B-35, later converted to a PR-35. And we've now been hands-on in the restoration process on the airplane for just over a year now. Realistically, it's going to be 8 to 10 years from this point forward. I would have been 14 years old, perhaps, maybe even 13, when I saw the airplane for the first time. One Saturday, I took my bike up to Calgary, and sticking out of one of the old wartime buildings was this long, gorgeous wood cylinder that I immediately recognized as a Mosquito, and it absolutely stunned me. I had no idea. Well, here we are 40 years later, and I'm again involved with the very same airplane, this time rather than just an admiring kid, but as the person in charge of the restoration.
I'm from England originally, so any airplane that was built over there from that era, and my father was in the Air Force, it does make you tingle because there's so much history attached with it, and it's just part of the fabric of coming from that country.
As a young kid, I've read many stories about the exploits of pilots like Tom Birch during the Second World War, and I was just fascinated by them. And it is an aircraft that absolutely looks right. It is right.
All these are mosquito bits that were taken off the aircraft at one time or other.
When we first looked at the airplane that was in Vancouver in the hangar, it was partially assembled. Nothing was really hooked up.
We had to get a crane to take it off the truck. So as we took it off the trucks, we put the wings on in the hangar. We actually assembled it as we unloaded it off the truck.
Didn't have anything in it, so I had to figure out how it was supposed to be wired and all the systems and how they work.
The plane first began being restored in 1966. Crews throughout the years have taken all of the parts off the plane.
And that always makes restorations much harder. Always things get lost, irreplaceable things. And that's where Mel and I come in, where we have to find out what it looked like, what it did, and how to make another one.
This is our supply of BS standard hardware.
Mosquito's a little challenging because there's not a parts manual for the airplane. There's lots of information. We have drawings, but there were so few airplanes, and you know, it wasn't built as a maintainable airplane. So a lot of the information you get from modeling magazines, pictures of other airplanes, looking at other airplanes, and experience of the guys working on it. So it's not too hard to figure all the big pieces out. Trying to figure out all the little stuff is a little more challenging, but it's all doable.
The plan is to restore this B-35 Mosquito to a military design.
This whole company is all about making airplanes fly. We don't do static displays or anything else. We make stuff fly, which is what airplanes are supposed to do.
Brilliant concept.
It was one of the great airplanes of the Second World War.
It's an iconic airplane. It was so versatile, it was so innovative. It was powered by an engine that just gives you goosebumps when you listen to it. And it did help win the Second World War.
The Merlin was the engine that certainly won the war. The Mosquito is the unsung hero.
De Havilland is one of the great aircraft manufacturing companies of the first 100 years of manned flight.
De Havilland made the decision to look at building an unarmed bomber that could outrun anything that might try to chase it.
It flew in the face of logic of the time. I mean, bombers were supposed to be big. They were supposed to have guns for defense. They're supposed to be made out of metal.
Build instead an airplane just big enough for a crew of two, four 250-pound bombs, fuel for 1,500 miles, and it would certainly be 100 miles an hour faster, as fast as a fighter.
But what de Havilland had in mind to make this airplane effective was to make it very fast, to put the greatest engines available at the time on this relatively light wooden airframe.
So it didn't need guns and gunners. It was faster.
So fast, in fact, that it could outrun any of the enemy fighters.
And it was built of wood, which was very innovative at the time.
Geoffrey de Havilland, he said wood because he saw that wood was not going to be a strategic material. Anything in war production is going to be made out of metal.
De Havilland stepped way out of the box and was persistent.
He took his idea to the Ministry of Defense and they sort of poo-pooed it. You can't do that.
Geoffrey de Havilland found an ally, Sir Wilfred Freeman, who was with the Air Ministry in England. And Freeman believed in de Havilland's design. Finally, the Air Ministry and the Royal Air Force said, you know what, let's just get these guys out of our way. We'll give them a little bit of money to make a few airplanes. So the initial contract order was for just 50 airplanes.
They designed and constructed the prototype here. From start of design to the very first flight was 11 months.
First Mosquito flew in November of 1940, so the war had just opened up a few months prior to that. And the airplane proved itself to be an immediate success, faster than any other airplane in the world.
He realized after it had taken off and left the chase plane, which was a Spitfire way behind, that it was quite a good airplane.
It was at that time the fastest combat aircraft in the world.
But here's the astonishing thing. This wasn't a fighter airplane. It was a bomber, faster than any of the fighters. So right away, everybody perked up and went, hey, just a minute. We may have something here. If it's faster than all of the enemy fighters, what if we did put some guns on it, not so that it can defend itself, but make it an offensive weapon now, make it a fighter plane. So in fact, the second prototype Mosquito was built as a fighter plane. So right away, as soon as they saw the possibilities, versatility became the key strength of this airplane.
The engineers have just returned from a fact-finding mission in Wisconsin.
Martin and I went down to Oshkosh and had permission from Kermit Weeks to crawl all over his airplane, and he had a Mark 35 Mosquito that was original and hadn't been touched at all, and it sits in the museum down there. And we went down and spent a whole day taking pictures.
Without any manuals at all, this is our only reference to things that we don't know where it goes. Realize how much stuff we don't have, and stuff that we do have, we know where it goes now.
Our squadron flew out of Banff. Our squadron was part of the Banff Strike Wing, which had four squadrons of Mosquitoes.
Our Mosquitoes we had the four night fighter squadrons. There were three straight night fighters. That's all they did was night fighting. And then we had one intruder that was all over Germany and Italy and so on.
We'd fly in and market, drop our share of flares, mark attack. The heavies would come over and bomb on our flares.
Daylight bombing trips on the Oboe, which was the V-1 rocket sights. We didn't come in at a steep angle, but probably about 45 degrees. You could get a lot closer or better accuracy with this, as we called it, shallow dive bombing than you could with straight and level bombing.
Low flying, over the sea, doing ship busting, which is what the Strike Wing, Coastal Command Strike Wing, was doing.
Over England, the south of England, as I said, we had the airports there, night fighters on them, and the Germans would keep an eye on them. Every day they were overrun, and we try to shoot them down. And sometimes we'd get them, sometimes we wouldn't.
We're installing the, call it a firewall. This is all stainless steel to protect the wheel well from any fire that might happen in the engine compartment. What we're looking for now is there's apparently rubber gasket material that goes in here and along the bottom, which we don't have, although we do have good pictures of them now, so we'll be able to reproduce that. Have you seen anything like that in our, or is that all?
That's all felt.
It's all felt.
I enjoy the challenge of that kind of stuff, making things that we don't have and we can't get, so we have to figure out how are we gonna make this work. So that's always fun for me.
A lot of the construction materials for these airplanes came from right here in British Columbia. The Queen Charlotte Islands, the Sitka spruce for the spars, and a lot of the woodworking materials.
This is our beauty, stripped down to its absolute bare skin here. This is where you see the birch and the spruce ply in here. And over top of this, the entire airplane would have been fabric covered as well. The other neat thing that you can see while our airplane is in this condition is the fact that the entire fuselage is not much over half an inch thick. The fuselage production is perhaps one of the most interesting parts. They had great big molds that they would lay the sheets of plywood down, and they would strap them with great big metal strap, and then they were so light that in essence it took only two people to lift half a mosquito fuselage off the mold. And then they would put the two halves side by side, and people would install the electrical lines, the hydraulic lines, the instruments, and all of the equipment in each half of the fuselage. And then the two halves were brought together, and so you had a single complete tube. Once the fuselage halves are glued together, a guy comes along with a handsaw and cuts this huge hole out of the center of the mosquito. And then the fuselage is dropped on top of the wing to mate the wing and the fuselage together. The wings are built as a one-piece wing. In total, it's got a 54-foot wingspan made as a single piece.
The wing basically carries the whole load. It carries the engines, it carries the fuselage, it carries the undercarriage, it carries the bomb load. Commonly said, fuselage goes along for the ride.
Not a lot of people know what we do here. It's slowly getting through the grapevine that this project is here, so we're having a lot of enthused people that have had contact with the airplane through the years. Either they built them in Downsview or they flew them during the war.
I've been working on it steady now for 8-9 months, I guess it is.
Yeah. Well, it's great to see it going back together again.
Yeah,
it really is.
Got about 750 hours on them. Different jobs, but I did not fly them during World War II. I flew them with the Overseas Ferry Unit.
I came to the Mosquito Squadron in Scotland in 1943 on a Norwegian squadron.
Everybody wanted to get on the mosquitoes, I think. We're just very fortunate. It had a great reputation.
Got the outboard tanks in and pretty well completed with all the lines made up. It was a struggle the first time finding out how to put them in because you have to put them both in at the same time.
Oh, brings back a flood of memories, of course. I just want to climb up the ladder and get in the cockpit.
I don't think enough people are aware of what happened in those days. We were only just ordinary people. And I'm told by a lot of people that the youth of today wouldn't do this, but they would. If they're faced with the same situation that we were at 17 and a half, they do exactly the same thing. If the same pressures are on them, they're no different.
Wars are horrible things. And everybody that's ever fought in a war knows that as soon as you forget it, you repeat it. So it's important. And it's really important to the vets to see all that stuff restored because it keeps everybody interested in it and nobody will forget it.
There is a set of drop tanks. They're made of plywood. They're not usable. The coating on the inside is eroded to the point where I doubt very much whether they would hold fuel. Mr. Jens wanted us to fit them with all the hardware so that he could use them as a static display.
The 50-gallon drop tanks, you could stay up for probably about 6 hours, 6.5. With 100 gallons, you'd get about another half an hour to three quarters of an hour on top of that. Just push a button and they drop off. Dead easy. But you made sure they're as empty as possible first.
And originally they were electronically operated so that they could drop them if necessary. And that had to be all disconnected because you're not allowed to do that anymore, of course. So we made it so that it was manual installation and removal.
Aesthetically, it's one of the most beautiful airplanes ever designed. It's right along there with the Spitfire and the Hunter and a few others that you just look at it and it's just got the lines and it just looks right. It's one of those classic airplanes.
One of the most beautiful, elegant airplanes ever designed. It sounds like nothing else you've ever heard.
The British used, and the Commonwealth forces used, Mosquitoes in every active war theater.
It was perhaps the first original multi-role combat aircraft.
It worked as a night fighter, a fighter bomber, photo reconnaissance because of the altitude. It could do all this sort of things that all kinds of different aircraft would have to do to achieve the same goal, and it did it all.
Just about any job you wanted to get done, you could do. And remarkably, you could do that job with just two people. There were so many planes that had crews of 8 or 10 that were getting shot down in huge numbers and many people dying. And the Mosquito, it's arguable, could have done a lot of that work if there had been enough of them with putting so few people at risk.
The Mosquito had the lowest loss rate of any Allied bomber during World War II. As spectacular as its performance was, it turned out to be one of the safest airplanes.
This airplane was originally brought into Canada by a Spartan, and it was used as a high-level survey aircraft.
Tyler and HMI. I was a navigator actually on the Mosquito.
Canada wanted to map the country so that it could be opened up for development, resource extraction. Anything you do, you need a map. Spartan had got into the high-level aerial survey business in 1950 using the P-38. That had its limitations, and so in late 1954 they went looking for a plane that could replace it. And there were these surplus ones sitting out in this airfield in northern England.
Spartan Air Services purchased 15 Mosquitoes for $1,500 each in 1954. 9 were used for aerial mapping, and the others were used for parts.
There were initial modifications done over in England before the planes were flown across.
So the Mosquito had a 6-hour 30 range, so then you could take advantage of the sparser airfields, and it's the only way we could have done it.
These particular airplanes have a very significant place in Canadian history. Although our particular example wasn't built in Canada, the work that it did here has a tremendous ripple effect in the maps that were produced, in the resources that were discovered, in the work that was done by these airplanes.
There were 3 crew members in the Mosquito. There was the pilot, and his job was to get the plane to altitude, to keep the flight line, and to keep the plane at a precise altitude.
So I was in the front as navigator, the camera operator was in the back. Since it was a small nose, you had to lay on your stomach. So I would just direct the airplane down a line on either a map or your own drawn map, or the camera operator would actually make sure we were getting the proper overlap of photographs. They're very exacting for everybody, really.
Isolated from the rest of the crew was the camera operator, who had this undesirable position in the back of the Mosquito's fuselage.
It was a high-level aircraft, so the photography is done either at 30,000 feet above sea level, and that would give you about a mile to the inch photography. It was tough on your body, because unpressurized at 35,000 feet is not a lot of fun.
It was hard work. The Mosquito was incredibly noisy. Everybody was pressure breathing oxygen. And there was also the tendency for people to suffer from the bends too, similar in the way that divers do when they're diving.
For Spartan, we started in southern Ontario. Started in the spring, usually around third week in May. And then as the snow melted and the ice melted, we'd keep moving further north, further north, further north, till you'd end up in the Arctic Islands. And then when around September, you'd start moving back again, staying ahead of the snow. And then in the winters, we'd go down to either Colombia, Dominican Republic, and do photography down there. So it was like, I always just think we're migrating birds. We go up and down. Wasn't a great married life, but that's the way it was.
You see pictures of these guys doing a full engine change in the Arctic in the middle of summer with nothing but the most basic tools. It was an incredible job that these people did.
We were living in tent camps for 3 months in the Arctic. We never thought anything of that. That was just like what you did. But the importance of the whole thing is that we created the map base for Canada. The whole map base.
What Canada ended up with was complete coverage of the country from the 49th parallel up to and beyond the Arctic Circle of this very large country of ours.
There's no mosquito stores. We can't go down to the corner mosquito store and pick up parts like you can for other general aviation aircraft.
Hey, good afternoon. Mike Ingram from Victoria Air Maintenance calling. Yeah, I'm just trying to track down some mosquito parts right now.
We have parts that are specific to a Canadian mosquito. Ours is a British mosquito. The other mosquito that's being built is a Canadian one, so we do have some parts that would be valuable. So we're hoping that that will be the case. It's just a matter of finding the right part.
There's only so many parts, so everybody works together. And pretty much everybody knows everybody. It's a small community. It's worldwide, but there's only maybe a half a dozen people that build these kind of airplanes.
Well, we were flying out of a place called Via Vicencio in Colombia. So the guy, Ralph Burton, he'd come in and we'd dive down, roll the airplane a couple of times, then come up, do a fighter break and land. So the commander of the airport came and talked to him and said, "You don't do that because you're a bad influence on our flying students." So we had to stop that.
It was a long, expensive, and very difficult process. They were creating airstrips out of the middle of Arctic wastelands in order to operate these airplanes. A number of the airplanes crashed. There were a number of fatalities as well.
I was with that company for 9 years, and I think there were 28 people killed. When you see one crew getting killed and you're flying on the same type of machine, you don't think about those things, though. You never think about them. You think you're always immortal. I was on one flight out of Churchill, going through 26,000. We lost the engine. The pilot feathered it, and there was a problem with mosquito. It would go into feather, then go back out of feather, and go into full flying. Well, then you had a runaway prop, 7,000 RPM. And we lost the spinner. The spinner came off and went by the perspex, and we lost several other parts.
CFHML's last survey for Spartan was in August 1962. It was grounded in Lakehead with a problem engine. It was one of only three remaining Spartan mosquitoes when it was flown back to Uplands. CFHML was officially retired in June 1963. With a total of 616.5 flight hours.
It was a real utility used airplane after the war, and that's why this one was actually saved and is in such good condition, because it actually had a life after the war.
We always referred to it as a Mozzie, never a mosquito, always a Mozzie.
It was the dream aircraft that most pilots would love to have flown.
It's a sweet airplane to fly, and it did everything you expected an airplane would do. It didn't have no surprises.
The opportunity of a lifetime. If you were a pilot and you had flown other aircraft, you'd get in the mosquito and say, "Hey, I've never seen anything like this in my life."
Flying to me was exciting. At that age, I was sort of immortal. Nothing was going to happen to me. It was always the next guy. Every day was, well, what do I do today? I get out and fly.
Fellow's on a Mozzie, he's lucky because he got an airplane, he got lots of speed, and speed wasn't a problem. Mozzie had the speed. You found the airplane, you could run him down. Because always you could cut corners, you see. As soon as he'd turn, you cut the corner.
D-Day, my logbook reads, covering airborne landings. You never flew over any ships
if you could help it, because most of those gunners shot at everything that was in, if it was in the air, shoot at it. The whole English Channel seemed to be full of boats of various sizes or ships. When we came out, they were bombarding it, but they hadn't actually started the landings.
Maybe once every 10 trips you'd get a, you know, you get one full of turn on you. But as a rule, they would always scatter and run. But occasionally you'd get one of their fighters, and he wouldn't turn and run. He would challenge. He'd be head on every time. He'd turn right in on you. And they were a bit of a handful.
My logbook says I think I did about 8 marking trips. We flew low, God, low below the telephone posts. When we were going over the water, we had to fly a beam at a very specific level and a fair specific speed, level, and altitude, because we'd pick up a signal and have to change course. Now, to be honest with you, my navigator was the king of this. I was just really the taxi driver.
The strike wing was aimed at flying over to Norway. A lot of the shipping was going up. Strike wing was tasked to do something about that, either sink the ships, damage them, or whatever.
We were dead hours in the dead of night, and we were in and out and on our way back, and we were lucky to come back all the time.
I've often heard it referred to as the world's longest continuous aircraft restoration, because essentially the airplane's been under restoration since 1966.
Unfortunately, a wooden airplane, once it's left outdoors, deteriorates very quickly. And what happened in this case was that when Spartan had finished with it, it sat outside for 3 years.
In 1966, Don Campbell purchased HML from Spartan for $2,500 and brought it to campus casing.
When I saw it and it came in from Ottawa, it was in rough shape. Fabric was peeling off of it, paint was peeling off of it.
Don Campbell picked the airplane up, thank goodness, you know, it's and kept it in storage ever since. This is the reason why it's in such magnificent condition as it is.
Dad's philosophy was air cadets should be working on airplanes. The idea was to restore it completely.
Campus Casey is not a nice place to build, to do things, because the decent season is very short.
Don Campbell, the original owner, had realized he wasn't going to get it finished for various reasons. So he found a partner on the West Coast who had the resources, and they shipped it out there and put a team together and started a second round of restoration work.
Mike Meeker could commit more time and resources to the next level of the restoration.
He was an airplane that huge. It was sort of all-consuming. But this was took on its a huge importance because of the age of it.
I first became connected with the Mosquito back in the early 80s when I was working at Abbotsford Airport. Somebody said there's a Mosquito in a barn up the road.
It was a spot you wouldn't have expected, really. It looked like a glorified horse shed, but inside was this just magnificent airplane.
The partnership arrangement came just after Meeker had purchased another B Mark 35 from Mexico, XB-TOX, with the hopes of building a new airframe and utilizing the metal parts and engines.
He hired a mechanics to help him take it apart. I think they cut the wings off with a power saw because it's all plywood and it was rotten. The plane was 14 feet high on the truck, and you legally only should be 13 and a half. I made this exit off this freeway at 60 miles an hour, and the sign said overpass 12 and a half feet. So I went under it, it sheared off a foot and a half off the rudder, which was rotten, which it came off nice and easy, and they didn't need that part anyway, so.
Once up in British Columbia, the plan changed, and the Mexican parts were used to aid in the restoration of CFHML.
It was pretty well all structural work that we were doing at the time. They got to see the process on how to work with wooden structure. And getting that plywood to bend in such a tight manner as it was a challenge, and it came out quite well.
For various reasons, the work ground to a halt.
The plane was then sold to Ed and Rose Zaleski, who put the plane into storage for years. In 1996, CFHML was advertised for sale for $1.2 million. In December 2000, Bob Jens, the current owner, purchased the plane and began restoring it once again.
An aircraft like this is passion. You could see that. Just the type of work that's gone into it, the care that's gone into it, and just the effort in getting this aircraft flying again. You can certainly see that.
In 2009, Bob Jens brings the plane to Victoria Air Maintenance to speed up the restoration process.
So this is an original radio. And the old technology that used to be in the Mosquito. And all used to run on glow tubes. And nowadays, a radio is a fraction of the size. So what we did on this aircraft is we took the back off this, I took the guts out of the radio, and we hid the radios within this box. So what we have here is today's radios. And all it needed was two to make this aircraft airworthy. That's pretty much what we had to do to make this a little bit more authentic.
The plane now has the Canadian registration, CFHMJ.
The original registration was FHML, but that registration got lost over the years and was never renewed through Transport Canada. We tried to get that registration back from the person who owns it now on an airplane out of Quebec somewhere, but they weren't so willing to give it up.
Another Mosquito has recently been restored in New Zealand and delivered to its owners, Jerry Yeagan, and the Military Aviation Museum in Virginia.
That's a big debate at the moment because there are people who are making the wings and the fuselages for them down in New Zealand, and that makes a very valuable contribution to getting others airworthy. But this particular airplane is highly authentic, so I think that does make a difference to, you know, that connection with the past.
The greatest percentage of it is original. The airframe's original, and the wings are all the wood that was in 1947. This is a unique airplane because of the way that its life was, and it was stored inside and made it viable.
The original propeller from the airplane, and it's just been sent out and overhauled at a certified propeller shop.
Just gotta make sure that's there.
Big trick now is get the propeller all straight so it'll just slide on the shaft.
Hold it. Going on 4 years now. It's a good feeling to be putting the last big piece on today.
Are you down a touch? There it goes. It's on.
There are old pilots and bow pilots, but there are no old bow pilots. We're taught that from day one. You might say, use some discretion or common sense. Don't try to fly under every bridge that you see, or try to mow the grass on somebody's front lawn or whatever it might be with your props. Be realistic. The aircraft has restrictions. You have restrictions. And sometimes things get in the way when you're low level.
As far as speed is concerned, I had one going in the stall turn where you pull it up and you kick the rudder and go over and come down. I had it doing roughly 140 knots. I know they're rated for around 400, and I've never put one through the gate.
We were the highest flying British airplane they had at that time, at 40,000. But 40,000, she was, you get up, the air gets thin, and you drop a wing, and it takes a while to pick it up and so on. She's a sloppy airplane in the air.
We had a radio altimeter, and you could set it at various heights. and it had three lights on it. We would usually set it at 35 feet as being the lowest, and below that a red light would come up. And between 35 and 50 feet, you'd get a green light. And above 50 feet, you'd get a yellow. So the idea was to try and stay in the green light.
And when we were within, I'd say, sight of the target, they opened up with machine guns and tracer and everything. And you thought everyone that came twisting up there was going to get you for sure. But we did our dive in on this marshalling yard. I opened up with the machine guns and the cannons and waved the nose around. And of course, we're coming in pretty fast, probably close to 300 miles an hour. And they quit firing.
The engines that were overhauled were the ones that were sitting in the airplane when it was mothballed by Spartan.
It's been since 1963 since this airplane ran. It's waking up after a long, long sleep.
See if it's actually prime.
Yeah, pull the line on.
Sounds like no ignition.
The bottom of the engine?
Yeah, the left engine started just fine. Right engine, not so much. We've got a boost coil problem right now and just trying to sort out the wiring for it and might need a boost coil.
The team has a spare boost coil. Once it's installed, both engines can be run up.
Could argue that getting those engines running as well as they do is almost an impressive achievement as getting the airframe put back together, because they're extraordinarily complex.
Banner Day, really. It is a significant day. In the history of this airplane, it is significant because it's been a long, long time.
The time has come for the Mosquito to shine. After 5 years of restoration at Victoria Air Maintenance, the plane is ready to test and hopefully fly.
The test pilot wants to see the gear, and then we'll do what we call an emergency gear extension. There's an emergency if you lose the hydraulics of how to pump the gear down by hand. So we want to make sure that all that works. So there's nothing left to chance.
I don't think there's anybody in the world that's flown more warplanes than what Steve Hinton has. There's nobody can touch him as far as his experience level.
Controls are balanced, obviously.
Because he's a mechanic, he understands a lot more. And I don't use the term just pilots in a bad way, but they don't always understand exactly what's going on out there when you move this handle. He does.
I don't have any experience in a Mosquito. I've read the books and I've flown planes similar to it and they've asked me to help on this based on the fact that I rebuild airplanes for a living and fly them as well. So we're just checking things two or three times is all. Anytime you rebuild an airplane, you're going to have, it's good to have a lot of different eyes look at it. And I could say 99.99% of it's perfect, so.
Did it kick out?
And we're having a little trouble with one of the main wheels won't lock up. And when the pressure comes off the hydraulic system, the wheel drops out of the landing gear bay. So we're just working through sorting out what the issue is. And it's a minor issue, and it's teething pains. And all these airplanes give you these sort of things right up until the day they fly.
I call it rag wrenching is the term I use all the time. Because when you rag wrench it,
You're wiping grease, but you're still right in the spot where you know you're going to inspect something and look at it.
They changed the spring on the uplatch. Seems to be working, that's coming off the jack, so that's a good sign.
Scenario B that will run it, check the engines and props and all that out, and then he'll go and taxi it and get a feel for the airplane on that before it goes flying.
Congratulations.
Pretty neat,
it's almost an airplane. It's getting there. Yeah, it's cool.
It's almost an airplane,
yeah. It's a plane, not an airplane yet. Yeah. Anytime you do a restoration on a plane and then you start bringing it back to life, you're going to expect to find little things, and that's all we've got is a bunch of little things. We've got twice as many little things because it's two engines.
This airplane holds a special place in my heart, not just because it's a former Spartan airplane, but because of the way that the owners decided to finish it, which is to do honor to the Mosquito bomber that had more operational missions than any other Allied bomber in World War II. It's a tremendously touching story that involves crew members and the airplane itself.
The tragic story begins in early May 1945, when F for Freddy of 105 Squadron was chosen to tour Canada to promote war bonds. The pilot, Morris Briggs, and navigator, John Baker, both had distinguished wartime flying careers. They are seen here, leaving Royal Air Force Benson for their Canadian tour.
I saw a very brief story, just a couple of paragraphs in an aviation magazine when I was quite young, and it mentioned the connection to my hometown of Calgary. So I started to look for additional information about this airplane and found there was almost nothing available. So I went back to newspaper stories and then started tracking down some of the people who were involved.
Richard was only 17 when he first began researching the F for Freddy story. In the past 30 years, seeing this history get proper recognition has been his personal mission.
It actually ended the war with 213 combat operations, which was an absolute record for an Allied bomber during World War II.
They arrived in Calgary, Alberta, the day after Victory in Europe Day.
And that was the official end of the war in Europe. So tremendous celebrations all across the country. The airplane put on a phenomenal flying display. For the pilot, he had earned his wings in Calgary in 1943. It was a bit of a homecoming event. Imagine putting all these factors together. He arrived in Calgary the day after VE Day at the station where he had earned his wings 2 years prior with the bomber aircraft that had completed more operational combat missions than any other Allied bomber in World War II. All of these factors coming together.
After a delay because of an engine repair, F for Freddy was to fly to Penhold, Lethbridge, and Medicine Hat before returning to Calgary.
They took off, and before they departed from Calgary, the pilot decided to do a flyby on the control tower. He did a couple of passes on the tower at absolute zero altitude, just pulling up to clear the control tower at the last minute. He did that twice, came around a third time, and hit a steel pole that was on top of the control tower. At that speed, the steel pole completely took the wing off the airplane. They crashed just outside the airport grounds. Morris Briggs and John Baker were killed instantly. And that put a real poignant end to the war for Canadians and Calgarians in particular. I'm very touched to see that this airplane has been painted up as F for Freddy in honor of those men who served and who died. It's an appropriate and very touching honor that's given to this airplane.
This morning we found a couple of leaking primer valves that are making the engines run a little on the rich side. So we're just swapping out some parts and getting the fuel leak stopped, and we'll get the engines dialed in. The list is getting smaller every minute, and hopefully the weather holds out and we'll get a flight test in today.
Starters.
What's the big term? Cook the starter motor. The starter button wouldn't disengage, and the starter got burnt up. These airplanes, they make their own mind up when they're ready to go, and when it's ready, it'll tell us, and we'll go fly it then.
A starter will need to be shipped in, so the flight tests are delayed for 5 weeks. The team is gathered once again to try and get the plane airborne. There are only a few remaining tweaks and the plane is ready to go.
It's really an early airplane. The cockpit's the way it's laid out. You know, everything is manual, and so that's it's part of the charm of flying a lot of different airplanes. And I enjoy it very much, looking forward to it.
It was a pilot's airplane. It responded beautifully to the controls. It was only dangerous on takeoff.
It had a tendency, because of the rotation of the props, had a tendency to swing to port a little bit. You could control it quite easily, mainly by the throttle.
There was nothing sluggish about it. It was just a say, just like our Ferrari. You had to be on the stick all the time.
Tricky on takeoff, because both propellers rotated the same direction, and it would swing on takeoff.
Taking off in something like that, where you've got a huge amount of power on a light airplane with massive 12-foot metal props giving you a gyroscopic effect, there's a lot going on.
There's so many unknowns. You can run the engines up outside and everything sounds good, the numbers are good, all the gauges read proper. You can work the flight controls and everything feels good, but as soon as you know, it's not until you get some air beneath the wheels and get the airplane off the ground that you really know what's going to happen when you put everything together. So it's a big risk you take when you take that first flight.
It's never old hat, but I don't get butterflies doing it. But of course, it's after completing restoration on a plane for all these years too. There's a lot of things that. There's some risk involved, let's put it that way. So, you kind of think about that kind of stuff and thinking about, how the aircraft system works. So some of the things you need to do without a checklist, so you have to be able to react to things. With Mel along, too, that I think that we've got the best of all the worlds. I think, we'll be fine.
Ground signal, pull the APU, pull the jocks, right?
And Mel is also a very experienced pilot as well, so he brings a lot to the table. If we have to troubleshoot anything, he's the best man for that.
It's exciting.
First flight, we're just going to orbit the field just around, and all we care about is see if the wings work and the engines run and get the feel for it.
He's just taxiing now.
CFHMJ waits for clearance. Main landing gear doesn't retract. They're only up for 10 minutes before returning.
When we open the throttles and let the brakes go for the first time, you think, well, this airplane hasn't flown in a long time. Flew like any other airplane. It trimmed out, flew fine.
The crew has a few items to adjust, and we'll need to figure out the landing gear problem. Hopefully, it'll be ready for its second flight tomorrow.
It was just a wonderful noise. Sound is more like it. Music to my ears. And brought back lots and lots of memories.
It's breathtaking to watch the thing take to the air and actually climb out.
Day two. The tweaks have been done, and the crew discovered that the gear problem was simply a lever falling out of engagement. They're ready for a second flight. It's important to get a number of flights and hours in to fully test the plane. Right now, the weather conditions are perfect, so the push is on to get up. And both landing gears go back up.
It's relatively easy to fly. It's not a maneuverable airplane, so to speak. It flies very nice. It's a very stable airplane, but it's a big airplane. It feels like a big airplane. It's just a big honor to be able to fly something like this. Yeah.
Over the next 48 hours, three more flights are taken. All the systems are running smoothly, and the job now is to simply test the plane.
Magnificent. An honor to be here. This one's on my bucket list. Seeing it painted as F for Freddy, a tribute to these men, and a story that I have researched for so many years. All of these things coming together, it was exciting, it was thrilling, it was satisfying, and very touching.
It was terrific. I just love the sound of it. You were very aware of the teamwork that had made that last little bit happen. Yeah, I'd waited a long time to see that happen.
To be the second one flying in the world, how can you describe that? You know, there's a few in museums and that, but to actually see one fly and make noise under its own power is really something special.
It's tremendous that there are still veterans around who served with these airplanes and who can see one come back to life. And I know it has a tremendous impact on them. But as you say, to the younger generation too, it's not just a museum piece. It doesn't just sit there. You know, it's something that makes noise and flies and is active and interactive and has an emotional impact that you can't understand until you actually see one, until you actually hear the thing fly. That's when it becomes alive.